Hey everyone, this is Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. My name is Meredith Carey, and as always, I am seated next to Lale Arakoglu.
Hello.
And this week we have someone very exciting in the studio. I'm going to just read this spiel like right off my piece of paper because it is so mind-blowing. Georgia Dean is an aspiring 26-year-old pilot who's already been around the world once with her dad, co-piloting a single-engine turboprop plane the size of a small yacht. She was 23 at the time, which like is... I was doing nothing at 23.
Doing nothing now.
You and your dad just completed an epic 54-day route in the same plane all over the place, starting in Colorado Springs and ending up in Greece and Jordan and Africa and Greenland and all of these other places. That was not the order they flew in, by the way. And you filed dispatches to Condé Nast Traveler the whole route. So Lale and I have been keeping up with your journey, but you just finished when?
I got back on October 17th.
Okay, yeah. So like 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
So how has it been adjusting to normal life on the ground?
It was easier than I thought, but I did come back to New York and have to do a full move, and I broke up with my boyfriend, and I don't have a job. Oh, so it's been more than an adjustment.
Do you feel like your travel, like those 54 days, were like this mind-opening? Because that's a lot of things to happen at once.
Yeah. It feels like you're in a different planet. I mean, you're very much so on Earth, and we're very aware of that. We were fighting gravity the whole time, but it's like a meditation almost. You just kind of, flying is so rhythmic, you get into a routine, and getting out of the routine is the hardest part. But other than that, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm curious because we talked to someone a couple weeks ago who went on this like 10-month journey with her childhood best friend. And the thought of, like, I love my dad so much, but the thought of spending 54 days in a plane with him is like a very overwhelming idea.
My mom and dad actually book separate seats on a plane because my mom can't sit next to him for that long.
So like first, like what was it like growing up with a dad who I would assume flew while you were growing up? That assumption could be wrong.
Yeah, you are correct.
And what was it like spending all that time with him on this journey? So two parts to that question.
Yeah, it was really fun having a dad who flew. I'm one of three girls. I'm the youngest. And I was the only one who really caught the flying bug. So whenever we would fly, I would be in the front. I've always enjoyed that aspect of it. Like, we would go on family vacations, and I would remember the flight, not the destination. So I was always kind of a nerd about it. And we would do really cool things. He loved any excuse to get in an airplane. For a while, he had an aerobatic airplane when I was in college, and I went to college in my hometown. So,
wait, what does that mean to the untrained?
So this plane specifically, it was a what you would train in to train for, like a fighter jet. So it had a jet engine. It looks like a jet. It has the canopies. You feel like you're in Top Gun. You like put a helmet on. And so Saturday mornings, we would go out, and he would do his aerobatics, and we would go fly around like these canyons in Colorado. And That was our routine. And so, I mean, I definitely took advantage of his flying. And then as far as spending that time with him, having done it when I was 23, around the world, that was almost 80 days. You know, you learn a lot about yourself and your dad. But when we went around the world, I had just gotten my very first it's called your private pilot license. And it's like your pilot's license light, I call it, because you can't fly in weather. You can only fly certain very small airplanes. So this time I had gotten my instrument rating, which is a much higher level, and I had got my complex rating, so I could do, you know, high altitude, all these, you know, pressurized cabins, landing gear. So I was very much so involved in the actual flying versus just the navigation and the radio calls, which I was the first time. And it was definitely a different ordeal with the two of us, just splitting those tasks. And there was trial and error because we had never done it before. And so when you're doing trial and error while you're crossing the Atlantic, it's
like a high pressure situation. Yeah.
It is and it isn't at the same time because no one can see you and no one knows what you're doing. So you're kind of like, I guess we're going the right direction. Like, this is still east, right? But yeah, I mean, there was tense moments. There was moments when, you know, we learned a lot about each other. But there's a reason my mom's in the back. Like, she couldn't do it. There's something about father-daughter that made it special.
Trial and error isn't a term that I like to hear used in the context of flying plane. What were some of those tense moments?
It's mostly just who's doing what. It's not that anything's being, you know, it's not like, oh, look, let's try this button, that kind of trial and error. It's more who's going to do what and when. And, you know, there would be times where we'd line up for takeoff and he'd look at me and I'd look at him and it's like, so who's taking off this airplane right now? Which sounds crazier than it actually is. So there's those moments. And then... when you're flying across the Atlantic, there's no radar. So like when you're over the land, pretty much someone always knows where you are, except for in Africa, so we learned. And so you're making position reports and you have to figure out the, you know, your lat long, which seems very archaic in an airplane. When you're in New York, you fly basically with an iPad and you know, they know exactly where you are. You know exactly where you are. When you're crossing the Atlantic, you're figuring it out. So there were some times when we would have to, you know, they would ask us where we were and I would go to find out one way and he would go to find out another way. And those moments we'd look at each other, what are you doing? What are you doing? But we always figured it out and it was never anything like we were falling out of the sky. So that's the good news.
Key yes, to this scenario. Yes. I'm just curious. So my understanding of what it takes to get a pilot's license, any level of pilot's license, is so many hours and like just generally being able to take so much time to have the practice time to fly. So like what was the process of even getting that pilot's license? Yeah. And when did you start and decide to start working on it?
Yeah, well, the big secret is it only takes 40 hours of flying to get your first license.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
But I mean,
that's like the opposite of the answer that I wanted to hear.
But it's not like any of those people would ever be flying your commercial airplane, so don't worry. But if your friend's like, hey, I just got my license, you should be like, I'm going to give you a few more hours. Yeah. But no, I mean, the FAA takes a very good, does a very good job of making sure you're up to snuff. It takes people average 70 to 80 hours to get their first license. I took my first lesson with my older sister, actually. And I think I was 16, 17. And she hated it. She got motion sickness, was in the back, like covering her eyes, like did not like it. And I, of course, loved it. I'd been doing it for so long. And then I actually didn't start taking my own lessons until I was 19. Started in college. And then I kind of had a falling out with my instructor. People think flight school is like Top Gun. It's not. It's just you and one normally dude. There are some lady teachers, but not many. So it's like you and one guy every day flying. And if you don't like them,
you're stuck in a metal tube hurtling through this guy.
And you're like, and you know, teaching techniques, like they, like this guy would just explain the same thing over and over again the same way. And I was like, no, clearly I don't understand this. Like, have you seen my landings? They're very rough. It's like I'm getting whiplash. And then once I graduated college, I was a guide in Alaska for a little bit. I was sea kayaking up there. And when I came back, I was unemployed and living in Denver. And my dad decided to do the around the world. And my mom, he can fly that plane by himself. It's a single pilot plane. But my mom was like, maybe you should help him. you know, it doesn't hurt to have a second person up there. So I went back to flight school and it took me about 3 weeks, 4 weeks to get up to snuff and get through it. And then I didn't fly after that for 3 years. Because it's not easy. It's also not cheap to fly an airplane. And then I got my instrument rating, which is the intense flying. So it's like, you know, when you're flying in an airplane and you're like, I think we're descending. And then all of a sudden it's just like the runway's right there. You learn how to do that. Accurately.
Okay. Accurately speaking.
Yeah.
Great. Do you remember the first time you went up in a plane with your dad?
I do not, actually.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I was that young. I do remember one of our first flights, though. He had a small plane, and it was a four-seater in the back, so it's what's called club seating, so you're facing each other. And so two seats are backwards, two seats are forwards. And one of my sisters sat backwards, and she got so motion sick. And so for the rest of our lives, I will always be the one who sits backwards in airplanes. And that's kind of my first memory of flying, is being like, you girls are babies. And they're my older sisters. So.
I think great. That also comes with being just like, yeah, the youngest is like the one who gets the short end of the stick and sits
always.
Backwards.
Yeah, right.
On that. I'm curious that after that like 80-day journey and then taking that three-year break, what was the impetus for this 54-day adventure?
My dad retired, pretty much. Yeah, that. And he was waiting to hear back about, you know, this one thing that was going on in his life. And he heard back that it was that this thing didn't go through. And so he didn't have anything to do. So off to Africa we went. You know, we go with a group of airplanes and they were already going. And so we're kind of just in a holding pattern, to use pilot lingo, waiting to see if we would join them. So it was already set up. And so it was just about whether or not we would join them. And it would either have been this year or next year. So it was this year.
And so when you talk about those, like this group of other planes, were you like encountering other people on this journey that were like doing a similar sort of thing? Is there like a sort of network of pilots that fly around the world?
There is. That's exactly it. They're called Earth Rounders. I should know the answer to this. World Rounders.
So the opposite of a flat Earth.
Yeah, right, exactly. You're very aware of it. And there's this one company that sets it up every year, and they've had to cancel for weather and political strife. That they, you know, there's getting through the Middle East is like threading a needle for sure. as far as where you can land and where you can't. So they set it all up. I mean, they have all the connections. There's a lot more to just flying your airplane. You have to land it, you have to park it, you have to fuel it. And those three things are not easy permits to get. It's not easy to get someone to release. You have to release your fuel. It's called a fuel release. And there have been instances where fuel releases came through for, because we were with a group of planes, and fuel releases came through for all of them except for one. And the fuel truck's just sitting there, and it's like, well, we can't give you anything. So definitely need help, because there's no way you could do it without the network.
I feel like in the dispatches that we were reading, there was always like a plan A, and then somebody always had a plan B. Like if you couldn't end up landing in this one airport, there was another one, or maybe another one. Like, who was your support? Who was the person like on their computer, like, okay, well, this is what we're going to do just in case.
Yeah, it's a company called Air Journey, and that's what they do. It's a family-owned company, so we were with the owner and his daughter, and he's a pilot, she's not, and they just, I mean, those two could run the world, I'm pretty sure. They have like a plan A, B, C, D, all the way through. Like we, at one point, we weren't sure if we were going to be able to go up through Sao Tome in Ghana. And they were like, all right, well, we can go back to Egypt. We can do this. We can do that. And we were like, how are you thinking of all of this? They're like, we're going to go to Malta, and then we're going to go all the way to Morocco. And we were like, yeah, okay, sounds good. So they're the ones who are really the brain power behind it, because you can't just fire up an airplane and fly it in a place like Africa. You can in the States, but so you need someone who knows people at the airport, because when you land, like, it's not like you have someone being like, all right, and this is where customs is. Like, customs comes to your airplane, and like, it's just a totally different experience, and you definitely need someone with an inside track.
Well, I feel like when you're talking about these borders, like, there was one border that you mentioned specifically that was like four countries coming together in the Red Sea and like finding the exact place to like fly the airplane so that you didn't cross any borders that you can't see, because no one has like a white line on the ground to be like, don't fly over this section. How did that even happen?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is at the top of the Red Sea, it's Israel, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt in the form of the Sinai Peninsula, which you are recommended by the American government to not fly an American airplane below 26,000 feet. So, I mean, that's not that bad. That's where we fly above that, but that ends about 5 miles from where we're supposed to land. So all of a sudden you're at 26,000 feet and you have to drop. And so navigating that's just pretty tough. And the way you do that is, and that's instrument flying. So you have GPS that's helping you, and you have patterns, you're talking to tower, you're talking to the other airplanes. And there's these paths in the sky. I mean, you'd be surprised. I can show you some pictures. It looks very complicated, and it's not. And I have our flight path, and we just flew a giant holding pattern falling out of the sky. In actuality, we were going down as fast as we could, trying not, you know, we knew where the other airplanes were, they knew where we were, and we were tailgating. It was a traffic jam up there. It was really wild. I'm not going to lie. You're sitting there and you're looking at Israel, and we cannot go into Israeli airspace. It's not an okay place to fly an airplane without a permit. So you're like, you're landing a mile from their border, and you're like, I guess we're going to go around it. It's like, it is intimidating. It is worrying.
So which country did you land in?
Jordan. Yeah. And Saudi Arabian airspace, they don't take lightly to unknown aircrafts in their airspace, and then yeah, so it was definitely, nothing went wrong and everything was fine, but it was definitely one of those moments where you got on the ground and you're like, okay, I have a lot of adrenaline going through my body right now, and we did it.
You're like, was that a really dumb thing we just decided to do?
Yeah, you kind of feel like that sometimes, and you'd be surprised, actually most borders have a road running down it.
Like there's a so room. You could actually see the little white line.
When you get closer, then you're like, okay, there it is, we're good.
Yeah, you might be a bit too close. <by time. laughs>
But yeah, absolutely.
What was Jordan like?
Jordan's beautiful. We were in, we went and saw Petra, and we ended up going into Israel for the day because we were there for 2 days. And that's just, this is one of those weird things that happens when you fly your own airplane in as crew. We tried to cross the border into Israel, and it took us, I think, 3 hours to cross because there was no proof that we ever entered Jordan, because we entered as crew and without a general declaration, which is a list of everyone on the planet. So, I mean, we sat at the Israeli border with Jordan for 3 hours trying to, like, you know, go see a dolphin in Israel. So, I don't know. But Jordan was amazing. Yeah.
I'm curious how much time you spent, because the general route, as far as I, and this is very general, but it was like you guys left Colorado, went to Canada, Greenland, and then Iceland. And then went like zip, zip, zip over Europe, and then went into Jordan and then down into Africa. How much time did you actually get to spend once you landed in all of these tens of places that you visited? to actually explore them.
Yeah, and I think this is the you know, the drawback of doing this as fast as we did it. The most we spent in one place was Tanzania. We were there for 5 days, which was really fun. But normally it was one or two. That was the standard. So a place like Djibouti, you spend one because there's not a whole lot to see there. And then a place like Mozambique, you spend two because 2 days at the beach. You know, Cape Town, you spend two. So it depended. But the cool part about it is you get to see these places in rapid succession. You can see how quickly the world changes. Like around the world, people are like, oh, did the world feel really small after you flew around it? You're like, no, there's so many people and there's so many different cultures. Like, it's a huge place. How are we ever supposed to get along? So it's a two-sided coin. But the exploration was, you mean, people always like, oh, so did you check a bunch of stuff off your list? And you're like, no, I need to go back to every place I went to.
Yeah, what were some of the places where you got to the end of the 2 days and both of you were just desperate to stay longer and it sort of felt kind of heartbreaking to get back on your plane?
Yeah, Tanzania, you could have left me there. That place is amazing. It's so beautiful. Cape Town, you just want to keep exploring that place. There's so much there. And, you know, Ghana was really cool, Morocco. And then Europe, you're kind of like, all right, I'll be back. Like, this is an easy one to get to. Jordan, I definitely want to go back. I mean, I'm just going to start listing every country we went to, so I'll just
stop
here.
That's like fine by me.
Yeah. I'm curious to go back to what you were saying earlier about like being able to see the world change. How do you feel your perspective on what places are like changes by being able to see them from above?
You know, you get a pretty good view of the civil engineering, which sounds really nerdy, but like, I mean, I'm a pilot, I'm a nerd. So you can see how a city's laid out. And you can see that when you fly in a commercial airplane, but when you see it through a cockpit, you get a 260 view or 270 view, excuse me, of what it's like. And so you see how it's all put together and you can see, you know, when you fly into South Africa, into Cape Town, you know, you're flying over the shanties and you see the big houses on the hill and you can see how it's, you know, built around Table Mountain, and that's really cool. And then some places you can see the pollution, some places you can see the agriculture. And but the biggest thing about flying when you're flying yourself is the people on the ground. And that tells you so much about a place you've come to. You know, is it absolute chaos? Do they know what's going on? And a lot of places, they don't. You land and they're like, okay, I guess you're going to come sit here and you're going to wait here. And our fuel truck is, I don't know where. And and then there's some places, like when you landed in South Africa, we got onto ground control. We landed at the big international airport. They're like, welcome to Cape Town. Taxi here. This is what you're going to do. And like, there's a full plan. And you're like, okay, we're back in like a very organized area. And so, like in Namibia, it was just a random strip, and there was like one guy there who like flagged us in and was like, the fuel truck will be here in a little bit.
And like, I'm your customs officer. Yeah.
Oh, we had to wait. We had to go through security 3 times in Namibia leaving because we were waiting for the customs officer, and they would be like, well, they're outside. So we'd go outside, and they'd be like, well, they're inside, back through security. We're the only people in the airport, and we're in pilot's uniforms, everyone, and they're like, can you go back through security? You're like, yeah, I'll put my iPad there again. Like,
I don't have anything with me. It's like the same guy.
And it's like the same guy is like, all right, come through, and you're like, I'm going to beep because I'm wearing this necklace and I'm not taking it off, and then they wand you down again. You're like, oh, my God. So there's definitely some stuff where you're just like, you just shake your head at the bureaucracy of it all, but...
I'm curious what the differences to you are, like, going through security as a passenger and as a pilot. Like, what is the difference? Because I always see, like, the crew line, and you're always like, oh, they get to go through faster than everyone else. even if you're just, like, as you travel now, like, as a commercial passenger versus as a private pilot, like, what is that difference?
It's super different everywhere you go. Some places, like Greenland, the guy met us at the plane. He like brings in a stamp. He's like, all right, stamps each passport. One passport he stamped and was like, that's not good enough. Flips the page and stamps it again. We're like, this is really, really formal. And then, you know, when we were in South Africa, you have to go in and go through the same customs area. But because there's no airplanes, like no commercial airplanes had landed recently, it was just us in like the huge customs hall. Some places you stood in line with the rest of them. Like, you were treated as diplomats more than we were treated as crew, because crew just walks right through. Mm-hmm. And like, we weren't allowed to do that. So people were like looking at us because we're standing there. It's a group of 18 people in pilot's uniforms. We don't look very official. Everyone's wearing like different colored pants, different shoes. Like, one lady was wearing cropped pants. Like, we looked like real ragtag. But we definitely got some advantages and some very big disadvantages.
You mentioned when you're like flying over like these sort of huge swathes of the planet and seeing how things like change from above. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned pollution being one of those mm-hmm. things. Was that something that really struck you?
Some places, yeah. And some places you could really see the emphasis on agriculture and the emphasis on creating structure. So it was pretty stark when, because over the west side, we ended up flying over the water most of the time. And over the east side, we flew over the land. And when you're flying over, you know, up where Egypt and Sudan and Somalia are, it's desolate. There's not any vegetation. It's very dry. And then you start to get into Ethiopia and the high mountains, and you can see that some areas are hyper-developed, and you can see where the deforestation and the erosion has started to happen. You can see where the mud where it's muddier and where the water's murkier. And so that's a big part of it all. Mostly what you can tell is the development, and not necessarily the actual pollution of the area, but the development and the effects of that and how that either is well done or poorly done and how that's affecting the environment around it.
Flying in Northern Africa, you crossed the Sahara, right?
Yeah.
What was flying across the Sahara like? Because I feel like kind of like flying over the ocean, it would just be like a little bit of a lulling, we're by ourselves kind of feeling.
Yeah, it was it's totally crazy. I mean, that flight in and of itself was absolutely wild. There was some prohibited airspace that we got totally messed up with, and they were rerouting us. We didn't have enough fuel. It was a very intense flight, and we had been sectioned off because most of the other airplanes were jets, and they had more range than us. We just had a little turbine prop, so we had to refuel, and we made a decision in the air to land in Burkina Faso. Like, it was a totally wild flight, and then we hit Mali, and they were like, "By the way, you can't," or Mauritania. They're like, "You can't fly into Morocco. You don't have the right permits. What do you want to do?" We were like, "Keep flying. We'll figure it out." So we were texting the ground crew in Florida, actually, and they were like, "Don't worry, we're going to figure it out." And so you're up there, and the guy is talking to you, and then he's talking to someone else, and he's talking to someone else that's so far away, you can't even hear them responding. And we realized that there's one controller for all of Mauritania, which is, if you don't know what it is, Google it, but it's a big, it's basically the Sahara, and you're flying over there with one guy. He's telling you have nowhere to go, and you're like, "We don't have enough fuel to turn around." And you look around, and you're like, and it is just desert. There's nothing. So it does feel like the ocean. If you had to make an emergency landing out there, which would just be a crash landing, controlled crash landing, you would be isolated. I mean, it would definitely be a little warmer than the ocean. when we fly over the North Atlantic, we have to put out what are called survival suits, which if you've ever watched The Deadliest Catch, it's those big red Gumby suits that they get into when they start going down. We have them like laying out in case you have to hop in one.
It's like a terrifying, reminder of what could happen sitting next to you.
Yeah, but the good news is if you're ever in a commercial airplane, you have more than one engine, so you're going
to
make it.
Good to go.
Noted.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like this sort of goes for life in general, but when you're in a particularly sort of difficult moment or a scary moment, sometimes you kind of learn something new about yourself, mm-hmm. And the way that you respond to these sorts of situations. Did you learn new things about yourself on this trip and also like about your dad?
Yeah, about myself. I mean, you learn to stand up for yourself, which sounds really silly that you of course you're flying on an airplane, but your controller tells you have to reroute, 400 miles west, and you have to be like, "No, we're not." I did learn a lot of standing up for yourself to air traffic controllers flying in New York doing my training. They're very serious people here. I mean, they have one of the busiest airspaces in the world, you get it, but they're like, you're like a learning pilot, and they're like, "Get out of here." They would actually kick you off. They'd be like, "You're done, you're out." And you'd be like, "Okay, we're gonna go home." So I did learn that through the training there. And then flying with my dad, did I learn anything about him? I learned a whole heck of a lot about him, and he did about me too. I mean, it's a different relationship. All of a sudden, I'm telling him, "Can you check the cabin pressure? Are you checking this? Can you dial this into the ADF? Check this radial, check this, make sure our nav's on the right thing, VOR." And, once I was in pilot and command, the tables had turned, and you're not very often in a place where you're not telling him what to do, but making sure that he's doing his checklist and I'm doing mine. And that was really a learning experience for both of us, because, I mean, he has 7,000 hours. He flew back when flying was actually difficult and not like a video game. So he's definitely in control. But when I was, taking the wheel, it was a learning experience for both of us.
Was there one stretch where you were pilot in command, or was it multiple times throughout the trip?
It was multiple times throughout the trip. And once we made this switch, which was Zambia to Botswana was what it was exactly. And then there were some times when we were flying when we were flying into Gibraltar, the winds can be really crazy in there, and it's a really wild landing. He's like, I'm gonna take left seat on this one. I was like, "Sounds good, Dad. Like, I'm on board."
Because how does that division of labor work within the cabin?
It's, you know, it's a good question. Cockpit, we had to, cockpit.
Okay.
Yeah. And we had to learn that, you know. I think in an airline situation or a two pilot when it's genuinely a two pilot airplane, it's much more rigid. But we were, you know, he's flown by himself for the past probably 4,000 hours. So to get him used to, and I had been flying a different airplane for my 130 hours I have. Figuring that out is actually a big part of it. But it ended up being the person who wasn't flying was doing the radio calls and the GPS, and the person who was flying was flying. Yeah, which the GPS and the nav is part of it, and then making sure the autopilot is doing the correct thing. And you're, you know, you're testing things, loading things. Like, it's pretty involved doing the flying part. But my sister, who sat in the back, she was with us the whole time. She's like, you guys are just like reading up there. You're like, sometimes, but we're monitoring. Don't worry.
It's probably the best but most terrifying flight I've ever been on. Was on like a small 8-person plane flying from Puerto Rico to the British Virgin Islands. It's like a little zippy plane. And they like put a passenger in the co-pilot seat because they need to fill all the seats. And so they're just like, please don't touch anything. and you're like, oh, okay. And in the middle of the flight, this guy like takes his hands off the wheel and then starts doing paperwork. And I was like, absolutely. And I'm like a pretty, like, I'm an incredibly calm flyer. I have made that trip now like more times than I can count, and for the most part I just fall asleep in the front, which is probably not great either, but it's always something that I forget, that like the plane can in certain situations just absolutely fly itself.
Yes, absolutely. You just kind of, you're telling it what to do and it's doing it. And I mean, there are, it's not like it's only flying itself, like you're putting the inputs in.
Yeah.
Because people will, I was talking to someone and they said something about bringing the power in and out, and they were like, well, doesn't autopilot do that? I was like, not always. And not on our plane, not ever. So you're still giving it the inputs and you're telling it which, because there's multiple types of navigation you can do when you're flying. There's radio navigation, there's GPS navigation, and you're making sure that it's following the correct one. And, you know, it's but it is pretty mellow. Like it, like once you're actually up in the air, you're stable. It's easy. Hopefully, that means it's a good flight.
What was the longest length of time you flew nonstop?
Nonstop, we can do about 4.5 hours. We can do more, but when the alternate situation, like in the States, like if you have to fly to an alternate, you're just like, you just get up there and you're like, all right, Denver Center, we're going somewhere else. Like, what do you got for us? And they'll help you. If you have to do that in, you know, Namibia, they're like, oh, we don't know. Where do you want to go? You're like, I have no idea. So we took it a little bit more seriously than we'd have to here. So it was about 4.5 hours, 5 hours. And then the longest day we did over 12 hours of flying one day. We flew from Reykjavik to Winnipeg against the wind the whole time. And it was the longest day ever. It was a 16-hour day, 12 hours we're flying. I was in the left seat the whole time. Thanks, Dad. Shout out.
You know, you mentioned this earlier when you were saying that your instructor was a guy and that there aren't a lot of flight school teachers, let alone female pilots. Growing up in a, you know, all, like, other than your dad, like a lot of women, how has your interaction with other female pilots been? Do you feel like you run into any a lot? It's like a really vague question.
No, it is. The women in aviation question is a good one. There are not a lot of lady aviators, aviatrix as they're called. And when we landed in Greenland, it's a super small airport, and we ran into the people who run the sightseeing tours. That's what it is. And they had one gal who was a pilot and one. The woman who ran it was the guy owned it, and it was his daughter who ran it, and you could tell by the relationship she was definitely in charge. And so we went up with the female pilot, and she was super young. She was 24, and she had been flying for 2 years. This was her summer job, and she was going up there and building her time, building her hours. And that was definitely rare. And I really liked that she had little diamond earrings in, and she had her Celine glasses on. And so I always love when people who do these, you know, seemingly masculine tasks are still, she's still very feminine. And I was like, yes, girl, you do you. Don't let people tell you how you have to be. I mean, you're wearing pants and, like, you know, cargo shorts and whatever. It's not an attractive thing, but I liked that she still kept herself in her personality. And then on the trip, there was one of the other couples the wife was a licensed pilot, and she did all the radios, but her husband did all the flying for sure. And then that was it for lady pilots on our trip. And then one of the couples, the wife hadn't done much flying, but she just started her private pilot license now because she's like, oh, what ladies can fly? And I was like, yes, girl, get in there. But no, there are not many of them. A lot more female controllers. And I do notice that when you're flying around in Africa and Middle East, there's a lot more women pilots on the radios than you ever hear in the States, which I think is really interesting, that these foreign airlines are doing a better job. Granted, everywhere besides the States, it's a lot easier to get in those commercial pilots' jobs. I mean, in the States, it takes years, and you go into severe debt, and like, it's not an easy thing.
It's a lot of money and a lot of time, for sure.
Yeah. So because it's a little easier in foreign countries, more women are getting involved in it. But it's definitely a man's world up there.
Did you find, sort of when you'd be on the ground and you'd meet new people, was there an assumption that your dad was the sole pilot and that you were just along for the ride?
It's interesting that you bring that up. So when we wear pilot's uniforms, the epaulets you wear, so that's the stripes you have on your shoulders, what became such a point of contention for me that by the end of I think it was in Mozambique, my dad jokingly switched his 4 bars for 3 and I put on 4. And then we just never switched back. So, you know, I'd be like marching around the plane with my 4 bars, and people, you could tell because, I mean, like a fuel guy doesn't know who to go to. And so they're looking at the bars. And yeah, they definitely would look at him, and he, hats off to him, he definitely would make a point of being like, I don't know, ask her. She's the one in charge. So he made a point of pushing that. But yes, absolutely, people were more drawn to him to ask questions and figure out what was going on with the plane. Even me sometimes, I'd turn around like, Dad, I don't know.
But that's you making that decision.
Yeah, it's true. This is true. Yeah. Using my resources, that's what it is.
And knowing exactly how many hours he's flown.
Yeah. One, you know, maybe sort of a note to end on. We sort of fielded the topic of getting a pilot's license and becoming a female pilot in our Women Who Travel Facebook group. And there was, you know, a lot of enthusiasm and questions about, well, like, how do you actually do it? What's your advice to people of all ages who think it's like a totally crazy idea, but actually want to make it happen?
Google flight schools in whatever city you're in and call one. It is that simple. For women in aviation, there's some scholarships out there. I mean, they're not going to pay for the whole thing, but $1,000 can go a long way when you're learning to fly. Most flight schools offer an introductory flight that's either severely discounted or free. And like in New York, I know sometimes they'll take you and do the skyline tour. Like you see them going around the end of the island and around the Statue of Liberty. And so that can be pretty cool. Just go out there and try it. It's not, once someone explains it to you, I'm not going to sit here and laboriously go through it. But if you go into a flight school, someone explains it to you, you'll be like, why doesn't everyone come get their pilot's license? It's so easy. You know, I remember getting my permit. I think I had to have 50 hours in a car. And it's like, I got my pilot's license in 40. This is crazy. So just do it. It's a lot. Just Google it, go, walk through the door. It'll be okay.
Amazing. Well, where can people follow your next journeys on the internet?
Maybe with Condé Nast. I don't know. No, I don't. I'm not a big social media gal. Never have been. But you can follow me on Instagram, Georgia S. Dean. That's me.
And you can also read all of George's dispatches on cntraveler.com. Lale, where can people find you?
At Lale Hannah on Instagram.
And I am, as usual, at Oh Hey There Mayor. We have another exciting announcement, which is that we are having another meetup. They're coming back to back to back, guys.
Just quick firing.
December 8th, we're going to be in Miami from 4 to 6 at an undisclosed location. So definitely join the Facebook group and get a ticket if you want to find that information out. It's over Art Basel, so if you're already going to be there, we would love to see you. Megan, Facebook group moderator extraordinaire, will be there with everyone. And if you want to also read more about why there aren't more female pilots, our lovely coworker Catherine LeGrave wrote a story this year for the Women Who Travel package that is on cntraveler.com. Subscribe. We're on Spotify and iTunes and all the things, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.